5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Driver, the first aid policeman, and had to set the precinct up in the building because they're under such attack by the white policemen. We first had that in 1938 or 39. Anyway, there were eight of them. I appointed four of them, and then I acted as chairman of that group. They tried to incriminate them and get them drunk and all that sort of thing.
White police, they tried to discredit them?
Oh, yes. That was terrible. That's one of the worst fights we had.
That was in the Hartsville, I guess.
That's on the Hartsville. That was the one thing we got out of Hartsville.
Why was he willing to...
Only because we put on the books 15,000, 18,000 voters. And that was the hardest job I ever had in my life, was to get that many people registered in Atlanta. Today, there are 100,000 of them, I guess. But it's a hard, almost impossible task, and it still is. Many blacks don't want to register and vote because they're afraid they're going to get involved in something, or their name is going to be on register. That's a big problem like that.
Even now?
Even now, you'd be amazed, a number of them. They might have been involved in something, had a little police record or something, or they just don't want to be identified. That sounds ridiculous, but that still is a major problem in registration. It took us 2 or 3 years to get 10,000 registered. But Hartsfield told me, I was director, executive director of the Voters League. That was my, now when I say executive director, it meant that while you have lay leadership, and you have to have top people like John Wesley Dobbs and A.T. Walden, you have to do the work. If you don't do the work, nothing gets done.
So you were the administrator, I guess.
Well, I never called it that. I was elected as the executive secretary with no pay, of course. But I had the facilities, I had the secretarial help, which you must have, and I had to put on a separate girl in my office to do nothing but handle community work. Mm-hmm. If the United Way and the others found out about it, I probably would have been criticized, but I had no money. We didn't raise much money, but I finally got it in. The Butler Street Y was an independent organization that was kicked out of the YMCA in Atlanta years before I came. So it was virtually independent, and it became totally independent after I took over as the executive, because we got no support from the downtown YMCA. It was one of only two YMCAs in the country that operated absolutely independently, and it does today. I mean, we have token relationship, and it's very good.
What year did you start as a...
I went to the Y in 41. The day they bombed Pearl Harbor was the day. I was with the Special Service Group building USOs. I was in Virginia. I'd been there for... I had been at Harlem as the program director. I left back to go to with the war service, and was stationed at Virginia. We couldn't get the stuff built because food material and other stuff was very difficult in 1939, 1940. So I got the Army to technically handle it. They had to build USOs, they had to build recreational units because we were having a lot of problems. At Port, it's a quartermaster unit, Port Petersburg, Virginia. And so then the Army asked me to take over the building of all the USOs in that area, which I did. I'm still active as director of the Petersburg unit, which was a quartermaster unit. The beginning of the war, blacks were basically cooks and so forth. Finally, and in other areas after Truman initiatives thing, but basically they were still being used as servants. But that's beside the point.
Getting back to the Voters League, I'm just curious about a few more things there. I came across a 1978 newspaper article in which you had been quoted. You said that due to the Atlanta Negro Voters League, Atlanta avoided disorders because we developed black leaders to establish black and white.
That's correct. Yeah. If it hadn't been for that, Atlanta would have been at the top, I believe. This is my belief.
Yeah.
I read thoroughly the riots in 1901 or 1898, whatever they were, and the killings that took place, and I knew. I had units all over Atlanta. I rented places, and my job in running the YMCA was to serve the youngsters of the community, and I had to set up branches, which I rented. I couldn't build in those days. I didn't have the money. But I knew the spots that were dangerous. I could go anywhere there, as I didn't even in New York after a few years there, because they knew that I was here to try to help them. But it wasn't a question of running the YMCA as a paid organization. I took kids that they could pay for, and I tried to make them pay a quarter or a dime to swim any way I could do to get money, but I didn't teach them out. And I still believe that's the program of the YMCA. But anyway, I set up units all over the town, Ferry Homes in Pittsburgh, which is a very difficult section. I had the best success there where we had the most, we did have at that time, very many people who would fight at the drop of a hat and that sort of thing. So after knowing what went on long before I went to Atlanta, I knew the spots to avoid. I have been afraid, and I'm afraid until this day, that if anything ever gets out of line in Atlanta, it'll be the worst race riot in the country. That's the worst fear I have, and have always had, because it takes a lot to get them started. But
In terms of the units you're sitting under,
that's right.
Units of the Y, units of the Voters League, or what?
Well, we set up units of the Y. That's the way I went into the community. Because I had to raise money, and I couldn't do it now. We then set up, of course, under the Indian Voters League, a special committee, and Dr. Baco, who died, was the first chairman of that. And I'm sorry, have you read some of Dr. Baco's
material? I'm sorry I wasn't working on the study when he was alive.
Well, he had more information than almost anybody. Now, he was succeeded by Jesse Hill, who became chairman, and Jesse did a tremendous job. And you haven't seen him?
He's a busy fellow also.
He's chairman of Atlanta, president of Atlanta.
I'm going to try and get him again.
But the key to this is voter registration and voting. But the problem, that's why they're having a terrible trouble today, is about the voter league, which is going to... They haven't been functioning too well recently. They've been under fire, of course. They had no money, and Marshall Field finally dropped them. But we're over some of those hurdles, so that the last election was a piece of cake, as they say.
Back then, did the white politicians actually seek the advice of black leaders?
After we got organized, every one of them in those days for 10, 15, 20 years came down to the YMCA. That's where we had all the meetings. And if they didn't get the endorsement, after we got 10 and then 12, 13, 14 registered, we voted in a block. There's no question about that. And when we put out, just 2 days before the election, we put out a slip. And all the ministers that had endorsed other candidates, I'm sorry to say, a lot of black ministers in town were for sale, and they could get money. We didn't have any money, But we did make them finally pay afterwards, and I had to go into debt many times to get this distributed. It was a very fine way we did it. We hired the best distributing agency in Atlanta. We put it in every mailbox 2 days before the election. And without question, for over 10 years, I never had known one that was defeated. They were all white in those days, so we finally got the place to run Leroy Johnson and Dr. Clement as chairman of the board of, member of the Board of Education. Those were the first two. But we were a very careful executive committee of the Voters League to be sure that we knew what we were doing. We didn't just go off and elect people. We weren't strong enough in those days. And the first one was Dr. Clement, which we endorsed and saw that he got elected. But Clement wasn't a cooperative person in the community. He told me to my face that his job was running a university. He couldn't divert himself to do other things. And even though my wife was working at the time, he and I had a terrible argument because I told him I thought the university should be a part of the community too. But Atlanta University in those days did absolutely nothing to work in the community. There's only one college that really did it, that was Morris Brown. Finally, now they give Benny Mays a lot of credit, but Benny was a fine person. He was a member of my board and everything else, but he was out of town so much. He was raising money the whole time. So until he really retired, Benny wasn't an active participant, but he had the reputation and he was an essence of integrity and a personal friend of mine, but I understood what he was up against. He had to finance Morehouse College.
Where did the financing go to you? What was it?
From wherever we could get it, but mainly we went into debt until the election. It cost over $2,000 to put those things out. And it cost a lot of money, maybe 8 or 10, wasn't much, I mean, after we endorsed a candidate, then we required him to pay a proportionate share of his fees. But we didn't do that. And then we put that in the hands of Mr. Yates, who owned the Yates and Milton Drug Company, and a Republican. I'm a Democrat.
I spoke to Mr. Milton last year.
Milton didn't wear the damn. Milton had nothing to do with it.
No.
No, it was Yates.
He was gone.
Yates is dead, but it was Yates. Besides, Milton's a Republican. I told you I'm a Democrat.
Robert Calhoun also.
Oh, John Calhoun's a Republican. You went to see him in his office at the line?
Right, it is.
He called me yesterday, Lord Shulman.
I was curious how much power the black leadership had during that period. Could they actually just say yes or no on candidates that the whites presented, or could they insist on a certain candidate?
Well, we had the main job in the early days was to sift the candidates up among the whites.
Make sure there's no racism.
In order to try to keep what we call the rednecks out, we didn't have power enough to elect a black. The first one, as I told you, was, and that was a big victory when we could put a man on the Board of Education. Now, that's a minor job, but it was a big. Then the next one was Leroy Johnson to the Senate. Those were the first two. And then Q.B. Williamson, even though he was a Republican. Well, it was supposed to be nonpartisan, as you can understand. I was very, very explicit about that. I was not. Whoever was the best candidate we got, QB was at the time, the one that could be elected. And Mr. Walden, who was the Democratic chairman, and John Weston Dobbs. Now, John Weston Dobbs was far more partisan than Mr. Walden was. Mr. Walden would go along with the committee, but John tried his best always. I mean, he's so obviously Republican, oriented,
But the wiring would come together?
Oh, yes. We had fights and everything. They took their coats off sometimes. But when we got together, we stayed there all night sometimes. They never went back on it. When we put that ticket out, it went down the line. And the public got to know that this, there was no buying or selling or anything, that this was a consensus of representative blacks. Well, that's my point of view. But it has to be honest, it has to be. You can have all kinds of disagreements, but when you come together, regardless of what happens, and for 10 or 15 years, we voted solidly and got every month. Practically, I don't think we lost any.
Two things related to that. First of all, what was promised to the black community by Hartfield?
We didn't make extravagant promises. One was, and that's why that was the biggest fight we had, was black police. It took us 2 terms to get him to do that. But he made it. I don't like Hartsfield. He was a segregationist of the first ward. But I could depend on what he said. When he said, when you can show me 10,000 votes, I'll put some policemen on. And he went down the line. That was the worst fight we had in the council in Atlanta. All right. But Hartsfield stood up to that, and we got 8 black policemen. I appointed 4 of them. There wasn't any question of examinations or anything. 4 of them living in my building. And I picked the 4 best people that were doing all kinds of things that they did. So we had 8. And then we had the problem. I had to move the precinct into the basement of the Y in order to keep them from being contaminated. They tried to make them, they were drunk and all kinds of things. But I was chairman of the group, Daddy King. I don't usually call him Daddy King. Daddy King was the vice chairman of that committee. And we stood by him. They did everything to frame him in the beginning. The first 2 years was terrible.
This is the other police, the white police?
Oh, yeah. Except we got him to appoint a white sergeant. I've forgotten his name. I never can think of his name. But when we got him, he went down the line with us. And when something was brewing, all kinds of underhand tricks, trying to get him involved in fights and all that sort of thing. The first 2 years was torture. But we did have this committee when a black policeman was involved. And 90% of it was pure finagling by the white police.
What was the committee?
Pardon?
What was the committee?
Well, there was a committee. Reverend King and I was chairman, and Reverend King was associate chairman. We had 2 or 3 other people. I don't remember their names. I had all this in the file, but they destroyed those files when I left Butler Street. I don't remember, but it was about a five-member committee that met. And Chief Jenkins, I have to give Herbert Jenkins a lot of credit. It took him a long time to get to come down the line, but when he did, he was absolutely honest and fair. That's all I can say. We had some cases that were where they were at fault, and we went along with it when we discovered they were.
So the committee was made up of just black leaders?
All black guys, yeah.
And you were there to?
I was a chairman.
Make sure that the black policemen were treated well.
That's correct. But you see, all this takes time and effort, and lay people, lawyers, people doing other things, they're so damn busy doing their job that they forget. I mean, the first time we got Leroy Johnson on the district attorney's office was due to a fight we had when Negroes split. That's one reason for the Negro Voters League, because Republicans went off in one direction and Democrats in another. And the essence of the league was that, well, the Democratic Party was building up, it still was very small. Republicans had a hangover, and Don Wesley Dodd managed father-in-law. I mean, we're pretty powerful in this town. And we knew we couldn't get anything through the Republicans. They have no real power. The Democrats have the power. So, in that light, they split down the middle, and somebody else got in. I don't remember who it was at the time. But anyway, that was what caused the joining together. And we had a very strong constitution. We could make have all the disagreements we wanted, but when we came together, finally, and there were real battles about it, so that we got politics out of the question. And the only thing we could do was, in those days, because we had less than 6,000 or 7,000 voters, it took 2 or 3 years to get rid of the county unit system. I mean, so we could, a vote couldn't mean anything. And then when we got that in 41, then we went to work on this, and then there was a political battle, Republicans versus, and there were a lot of blacks still very Republican. This was before Franklin Roosevelt and all that. So, but we set the pattern, and the thing that gives me more pleasure than anything else is the feeling that we had the community with us 100%. Every election went down the line, and I was trying to think that all that goes on here now. Now, these were all votes we had to go with in those days, until we started with Clement, as I say, and then Leroy Johnson, and that was a political appointment, pure and simple. In those days, Leroy was teaching school, and then he went to North Carolina school and took up law. We had to put him on the district attorney's staff. And that was his first way into. We had some questions about Leroy even in those days, but and from there, of course, Leroy was a good politician.
What year was it that when he got on the street?
That was 1949 or 51.
It was right after the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did the league eventually split later on? I guess it's early 60s, I guess.
In the early 60s, Jesse Hill was partly responsible for it. They got the place like they always do. It's one reason I left Atlanta. I mean, everybody was amazed that I took the job in New York. But I got so disgruntled at the way they began to tear it up, and there was infighting and all that sort of thing. Everybody was trying to grab. This is the one thing that you have to understand in dealing with racial politics, or racial anything. People are jealous of one another. I had a deal with Scott. I didn't have to worry about the Journal of Constitution, because they never carried any Negro news in those days at all. Never mentioned anything. But the world did. But they would never mention my name. I had to have complete anonymity, because the minute you stop trying to exercise authority or become prominent, they start shooting at you. And the only reason I was able to persevere was because I insisted that I always operated behind the scene. I wasn't interested in one thing in any notoriety or publicity, but they all were, everybody were. I suppose it's normal in that, up to a point, but it's worse in the black community. And the minute, and then we had all the black preachers to contend with. And I'm sorry, but a lot of them are susceptible to money. That's the one thing. If I had to put my finger on one thing Negro voters leave, and I can give you time and date almost for this, because I had to exercise tremendous power to keep them whatever money we got in out of the hands even of some of the leaders. Not that it was, but just charging for things that I thought were not worthy of paying. Since we had so little money, you understand. But we had one man, he's Republican, that's C.R. Yates. And people ought to ought to be eternally proud of Mr. Yates. He handled all the money. I never touched a dime of it. But I, as the director and so forth, the secretary, I had access to it all and got it all because he did. But Yates was as honest as the day is longer. A lot of things happened to make that group. Because the minute you start finagling with money and that sort of thing, or if there's a suspicion that you are, you see, and there's a lot of it.
But you were able to stay together at least until the 60s?
We were right up to 63, 64.
What was the problem? Did the younger blacks, let's say...
John Boone came to town. Did you ever hear of him?
What was his name?
Boone. No. Jesse Hill got ants in his pants, and three or four of them decided they weren't moving fast enough. So they tried to... I sat in on two or three of the groups. They reorganized three times until it all broke up, and it broke up the voters' league too. They wanted to go faster.
Just disagreements about?
Candidates and everything else.
How fast they were putting blacks
up? That's right. They thought we weren't going quite fast enough. Not, perhaps we weren't, but we didn't have the power in those days. This had to be a very calculated type of thing, and you had to know where you were coming from. We didn't have enough registered voters yet.
Was there a concern about, let's say, resentment about you devotedly controlling who runs for office?
That didn't seem to come up much. I didn't get too much criticism. I got some for being too direct, because I'm very forceful when I hate. And I don't always use the most conciliatory approach. But I refuse to be a party to anything, and I never exposed anything, but I knew a lot of things that were happening that were not kosher, and I wasn't going to be a party. And it's a political game everybody plays, I suppose. But I'm not saying that I'm saint or anything, but I refuse to be a party to anything. I'm relatively poor today because I never made any money. I wasn't being paid at the Y or anything else. But as God is my judge today, I never took a dime and never let anybody that I know involved take a dime from anything. Or not take it, I mean, or steal it. But the various ways when money starts coming in, you can use it and be maybe perfectly legitimate, but you know damn well it's being used.
To divert it away.
Yeah, divert it, that's...
So, we just said that Jesse Hill, what's his name?
Jesse wasn't that, no, Jesse just wanted power.
But he was one of those who...
He was one of those who...
Content with the...
Yeah, you know, was going too slow.
How about the Atlanta Inquirer, I guess, too?
Oh, the hell did he let it go? They came on the scene. They were rabble rousers. Are they still operating? I don't know. No. I mean, that was one of the ones, but
I think just the world was being
taken out. No, I mean, yeah, they you got just as, well, you didn't have in those days, but you begin to get just as many blacks that are, like Farrakhan, is that his name?
Oh, Farrakhan.
Farrakhan.
Yeah.
He's not as vicious as he is, but even Jesse Jackson, you know, isn't accepted in this community, Parkland. There's a terrible suspicion about Jesse Jackson. Now, personally, I have reserved judgment, but I just don't think. Well, I don't know. It's a variety of things, reading mostly and talking to people. But I don't suppose you can ever get people that are absolutely harmless. But the expression, the feeling in Atlanta is generally, and I know the feeling among blacks, that Jesse Jackson is a prima donna. That he's a... There's nothing sincere about it. You can get a feeling about people, you know. And we've got plenty on the council right in Atlanta today. I wouldn't support it, even though they're black. And it wasn't a question of black at any cost. I don't think this town or any town should be racist to that extent. Now, people accuse me because I'm a mulatto. I had that to contend with. And I always will have. When I first came south, that was the biggest job I had, not here, but when I went to teach at Fort Valley. And I was director of Fort Valley for 5 years. And so I had to overcome that. But the only way I did it was by working with people. And the same thing I had here in Atlanta. When the first time I came to it, when I first came to Atlanta, at the Wild, it was a very small institution operating on less than $50,000 a year. And the minister of the Congregational Church was the acting director. He didn't have money enough for a director, he was acting. And the biggest fight I had was to prove that that I was not, even though I'm a 7/8, what the South Africans call colored. I mean, frankly, I know exactly what I am. My people are from Charleston, and they're very prominent. My background is very prominent in Chicago, but I spent all my life doing nothing but trying to prove to myself and the black that I was for total racial equality. And I had to start with the blacks because Atlanta was full of racism among blacks. I wouldn't accept invitations to so-called mixed groups and so forth. The Y was run by mixed groups. I had to get all of that out. I went overboard then, the total black. And if I had got any credence, I suppose it was in that area. Because I wasn't discriminative against mixed group. But that's something that people don't talk about much, but it's a very important factor.
What sort of mixed groups mean?
I'm talking about black, the so-called, if you have 0.1%, you're black in Georgia. And it isn't like South Africa. And in the early days, just like in my hometown, not my hometown, because I was born in New York, but most of my brothers and my mother and father were all born in Charleston. They wouldn't let certain blacks in certain churches in them. These were black, colored churches, but they were, it's run on the texture of your skin. You never knew that.
I have heard that.
You've got to study it a little bit, because it's a very important.
I heard there was sort of a gradation in terms of.
Oh, yeah.
I guess. I thought that the lighter skinned blacks were the ones who were, I guess, the higher levels of the society. But no.
Well, I mean, they are, because they are accepted. One of the biggest. I was accepted everywhere in Atlanta after they knew I wasn't a communist. That's the first thing they do, would be sure I wasn't a communist. And then after they discovered that, I raised more money in Atlanta I raised more money in the YMCA than any black executive in the YMCA. I raised millions here in Atlanta to build all these buildings they got. No. Money was at white. Blacks don't have any money, they still don't. I don't know, but they don't have much and they don't give when they have it. I'm sorry, but that's. But I was able to do both. You have to walk a tight rope when you're doing this type of thing. Walter White used to write a couple of books about this if you're ever interested. It's a hard road to hold. And mine was complete devotion to the cause of equality. Regardless of this crap about my wife, it happens to look almost like I do. She's partly Jewish, in fact. But her father was a Jew. We're both committed to equality. That's all. I mean, hell with color or anything else. And I was advised at college. My own college, University of State of New York, before I graduated, to to what they call past, to forget that I had any Negro blood in me. That to me was a direct indignity in which I refused, and that's why I didn't have to come south, but I did. I have brothers, I had brothers, and nephews and others, all who were born in the other direction. So this has been a personal fight with me.
It happened to like me?
Yes. I have a nephew who's bishop of the Episcopal Church. He's my brother, my oldest brother, brought him up as totally white. Now he's bishop of the Episcopal Church. I know it because I talked with the bishop of the diocese before he was accepted as a minister, as a preacher in the area. So there's no, he's not piling on the false colors, but I'm saying it's nice to know that they've arrived at that place, but there's only been two black men who've been bishop before all Episcopalians. I'm an Episcopalian. I grew up in the church. In fact, the Episcopal Church was responsible for my coming south. I couldn't get a job teaching in the North.
You think that you were better able to get funds from the white community because you were white?
No. I was able to attend meetings and not have them embarrassed. Mr. Yates and I, Mr. Yates was also. So we, when they started the comms of conscience, they wanted to invite somebody to join the committee. I got into areas that others wouldn't get in those days. And then when I formed the Hungry Club and others, I was able to get them to come finally.
When did the Hungry Club was formed?
48.
So the white politicians didn't come to that?
Not at that point, no. They didn't come to about 50.
To speak.
Yeah.
A few other things in terms of cooking. But I was curious why you supported Miss Sell against Jackson in 1978. You faced this representation.
Who told you what?
I'm going to pick it up in the newspaper.
Well, it was part of my philosophy. I went to Maynard and told him I didn't think he was ready. We were very satisfied with myself, a Jewish person, and Maynard, a black person, you know, light skin. And I thought we had a good, and I thought Maynard ought to wait. I had nothing personally against Maynard, but I thought he should wait. Now, I knew Maynard, and I knew his family. I had worked with his father. His father had a mental situation and died. But his father came here from Texas, and he was a minister, very prominent minister of Dallas or Houston, I forget which. And he was the son-in-law of John Wesley Dodge. And I've taken Reverend Jackson home two or three times when he went off on West Chapel Wagon, whether he was mentally buried. And I tried to tell his father, who was was trying to go too fast. Dobbs was trying to push his father. You don't push yourself on the ground. You have to earn your way. And part of his trouble mentally was, and then he had trouble building a house over there and all that. They wouldn't give him licenses to rebuild it or make it two times or something. Anyway, he had a lot of problems. He was minister of a very important Baptist church over there, Friendship Baptist Church. And no, I knew Maynard grew up in New York. Maynard was a very smart boy, but he was very aggressive and very, very, well, sometimes he was obnoxious, I mean. And he was he was being pushed, of course, by Dobbs. The fact that they were Republicans at that time didn't enter the picture, I don't think it did. And I thought we had a good mixture, Maynard and Massow, to prove that it wasn't just black. We didn't want just, Massow had done a fairly good job And he was being shot at in many directions because of his brother and so forth. So I went to meet him and I told him that I was going to support myself. And myself hadn't done a thing for me or anything. I wasn't even personal about it. And so I did. I lost. And I was blackballed from that on out, of course, by Maynard. But even to this day, I have questions about Maynard. I thought he went too fast. Now, damn it, you can make whatever you want of that. It isn't a question of pro-white or pro-black. Things take time, and you have to get the best people you can get. They must be like Caesar's wife, above reproach. That was my philosophy. And I just didn't think Maynard had that. He did nothing but create dissension during the whole administration trying to... I thought that was wrong, you understand?
Yeah.
Simply because he was political.
In which things? Like the minority contractor?
Yes. Yeah, he went all out. Now, that was necessary up to a point, but... there's a way to do it, that you don't get involved and people criticize Andrew Young and all that. But Andy is a good politician and a good person fundamentally. He's honest and he makes mistakes and maybe he's a little lazy, I don't know.
Or too honest in front.
Yeah. But we were just breaking in. You don't take it by storm, do you understand?
Yeah.
You have to prove that you can mesh into the situation. You may have to take some defeats temporarily, but you always stand on virtue and integrity. You don't try to just bombast. Maynard was too bombastic.
I guess he came to conflict with the White Business Committee.
Yes, he did. And maybe you have to have some of that. But if this is a failure or a weakness on my part, I'm sorry, but I haven't changed any one way or the other. And it isn't because I've got some nice blood in me either. I think I've proved that I can...
Well, I can understand your point of view.
Well, this is something very difficult that people don't understand because I got a lot of criticism for it.
Well, I guess to a lot of people this was a big black breakthrough. Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think... I thought... told him at the time that everything would be in his favor if he would go through one other term with him. Because that was an ideal situation, a Jewish mayor and a black vice mayor. And Massel had done a good job. He was criticized because of his brother's stuff with nightclubs and so forth. But well, I mean, that's my point of view about that.
How about a little earlier? In 69, apparently, the cell was supported by the American Enquirer over Tate. Some black leaders supported Rodney Cook, a white fellow. I'm just curious why that mixed response from the black community. Do you remember that earlier?
I remember. Tate's from Fort Valley. There's a Fort Valley long after I was elected there. Tate became senator. Tate was another man that I never could really go all out for. Rodney Cook, I didn't have too much of him, but I didn't have too much influence at that time. I didn't support Tate. I think we did. What year was that?
69.
No, I had left then. I was out of the picture.
I was just curious because it seemed to be such a split in the black community. Why? I mean, Cook was once some supporting, Tate was another one, Marcel was another one. Seemed to be a real three-way...
Tate never sold himself totally to the black community. He was, he has integrity and everything, but there's several things about him I don't know. We had supported Cook, for years or so. But you see, this question comes up in terms of white versus a black. The hell with that. Whoever's the best man who ever can do the job, whoever can stand the gap.
Well, I think that's true, you know. I think white fellows wins every time.
It's going to take a hell of a long time to get that point over. I mean, because it's just as racist for blacks to vote blindly black as it is for whites to vote for rednecks and others because they're white. I think we've got to get rid of that.
That's
not the most popular view. When you,
that's a long time coming. Yeah.
Well, we've got to make a beginning on it. I mean, we've got to let race fade into the background, even though we have to begin on that basis. I'm sorry, but I mean,
I understand. It's been a long time since Jews tend to vote with Jews, Irish tend to vote with Irish names, and so on.
This is the worst thing that can happen in America.
I agree.
You're going to polarize the country, and I'm afraid that's what's beginning to happen. I mean, America isn't that type of country. I mean, some people even endorse it. I don't know if you're ever going to be able to get rid of it.
I know how you're feeling today. I was also wondering whether it was, you feel it was sort of a tradition of black-white cooperation in Atlanta?
A tradition?
Yeah.
No.
No.
You had to force it at the beginning. It's beginning to crystallize, and I think that's just a very slow process.
But you don't feel that the whites in Atlanta are more willing to sit down with blacks at that period of time?
Only when they have to, only because they're almost compelled to know.
Yeah.
And it has to start that way, I guess.
Well, how about earlier when blacks had some control of the bond voting?
Well, everybody was only doing what was in his personal interest. I mean, I don't think anybody does anything. And in many ways, it's getting worse because people today are only interested in what's in their own personal interest. And this business, even black, I get to the point where whatever is involved, get money, overcome their poverty and what they've been through. This is dangerous. This is very dangerous. It's not building a sound society when you go that route, it seems to me. I've read a lot of history. I mean, I'm not a historian fundamentally, but as I've grown older, I read history probably excessively. And I know that change takes time, but constructive, sound change has to take time. You can't force it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a gradualist, because I'm not. When it's necessary and you have the opportunity to force an issue if you're right, then I think you should do it. But a few years is nothing in the scheme of things, as you know. The older I get, I guess, you mellow and you begin to change a little, but I don't think I've changed my fundamental principles. I don't think so. I was impatient, a little more impatient when I was younger, but I always was cautious, and I was looking for what I thought was right. That sounds corny, but I am an Episcopalian, but I am also a religionist. I'm a very strong believer in the teachings of Jesus. And if any one thing I know, it is his life and history. And I knew what he was up against. And I tried to run the Y that way. I tried to run the schools that I was director of. Not by preaching, I don't preach, but by precept and inner understanding. Now, it may sound corny to you today in this world of big business and everybody after everybody else, but I never made a lot of money. I could have. I've been offered money many times, but I turned down. As God is my judge, I can say to myself, I've never taken a penny when I could have. I probably could have been pretty affluent, but somehow I always was able to pay my bills and accumulate a little. So I have no regrets.
Do you think there's any particular reason that the magic became the center of the civil rights movement?
No, I think it was the natural thing.
Why?
Because Atlanta had demonstrated that by a process of working together, it could work out differences without conflict.
So there was some sense of
morality. Even when the thing was at its height, we had all kinds of meetings with Riches and others. We finally had to make some concessions, and they would march and so forth, but they wouldn't fall down in front of the cars, they wouldn't impede traffic. And then I personally went to the sheriff's office and the police commissioner. The sheriff was to handle it. And they would arrest them when they had to. They would not put them in cells. They would hold them, and I posted a bond. I posted, at least I went surety for $100,000. And Ruby Williamson was another one that was able to. I had this type of relationship with the sheriff's office. So they wouldn't put them in jail, they would hold them, and then I would sign the bond and so forth. But it was that approach rather than this stuff they had in Montgomery and in Alabama. Maybe it was necessary there because we didn't have the type of people there. But these people in the turn in Atlanta had been taught. I mean, and the main thing was this is the one thing we worked against the early years before this league. That's all we could do, and it was a very good thing to keep out of office as near as possible up until Lester Maddox. The rednecks. That's the one thing we were able to do. And that was a big thing, and it has led to understanding. We worked with what we call the 8th Ward. People from that ward, which is Buckhead in the community. Now, if you can deal with people of some principle like you, it means a big thing.
But so there are actually some cases where you would actually say no to a particular white candidate.
Oh, many times.
You don't want my opinion. So there was some sense of cooperation.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I mean about this long tradition of working together between the races. Yeah.
Well, that's what started it. I mean, that's what, up until then, you know.
So in other words, I guess the city was sort of almost the perfect one for the center of the nonviolent movement.
That's correct.
You think?
Now, in the beginning, we didn't want King here, you know. We didn't want him.
Why?
We thought he would tear it up after what happened in Montgomery. And there was not a whole lot, but he wasn't welcomed with open hands when he came here. And we thought that we were making progress, slow but sure. And now, personally, I worked very closely with Martin Luther. I opened the Y. I always had spaces there, dormitory spaces. I had a special fund for feeding youngsters who didn't have any food. I was very careful in screening them, but Martin Luther came to me. Martin Luther grew up in the Y, incidentally, so I was very close to him. He was chairman of part of physical division. He made me make some changes in the early days. He did members a little more freedom than they had. So Martin Luther and I were very, very good friends. I didn't have as good relationship with his father, so-called daddy thing. He tried to make me stop dancing, take out the pool tables and all that. And I had to get money when I first came here. And he was off the record. In fact, he was very limited. If I heard anything, I didn't say it. He tried to tear up a lot of things simply by taking a negative point of view. And he was a member of the council, executive committee. And every time he saw him coming, we had to invite him. And he would always find something that he could object to.
This is the buffer.
This is Gordon's name.
Oh, this is, okay.
Gordon's name. No, I would never put him on board. I wouldn't have him on the board because I was going to have dances for young people. I was going to have pool dances with the regulator.
So what was his problem? That's probably moving too fast about that?
No, fundamentally, I don't think he thought that far. Now, his own son, he never got along with his father. His father went too early. I set up a special, I had what they call a special dinners, modern friends or something, on Thursday nights. Big dance, people came from all over, had 600 or 800 people. Never had any drinking, never had any carousing, never had any fights. I'd always employed one deputy sheriff. But I ran that for years, and Martin Luther came to me while he was a student and asked me if I could set up something for him, for his group up at Ebenezer. So my dance was on Thursday night, Friday night. I said, the only night I got is Thursday night. And he said, I don't want my daddy to know it. I said, okay, you get permission. And just youngsters from Ebenezer. And so for over a year, I had a night with him alone. I don't know whether Reverend Van Helping seemed to ever knew about that night, never came up, but it was a very nice small affair. And in many conferences with Martin Luther Jr., he would intimate to me that his father was so restrictive that he couldn't do anything. But he finally did come here after he finished what he thought was his work in Montgomery. And then he had a lot of people coming, white and black. And he had no money, so I let him be in place. I always kept dormitories free, which I didn't charge for it. I had money, but he didn't have any money, and I would give him food and drink. So I worked very closely with him. But at the same time, the Voters League had discussed this many times, and they were so afraid that after all the trouble in Montgomery, and I had gone to Montgomery several times to work with the Y because it was a very difficult situation. They wouldn't even let the NAACP meet in the building in Montgomery. And since I had been considered a sort of a troubleshooter among YMCAs, I went there to North Carolina and other places. The National Council had asked me to do this. And so I knew the situation in Montgomery very well. But anyway, when it was decided that he was going to sort of act as associate pastor, that was just to give him a title, I mean, he preached there sometime, worked out of it. But the Voters League never overtly voted against it. Against working with him. There was very little cooperation.
What year?
We're talking about 57 or 58. And the fear was, which wasn't overtly expressed, was that we didn't want to tear it ladder up. Daddy King himself was went on record about it. The only time he got famous was after Martin Luther got killed. And now you will infer from this that I didn't have much of an opinion of L. King Sr. I didn't, because I thought he was sort of stupid. And You'd have to. All this bad pain and so forth. But you had to tolerate Reverend Peace and me. And that's what we did, just tolerate him, because he was an objectionist all the time, trying to find something, sometimes absolutely ridiculous. After we worked on something for a long time, then he'd come up all of a sudden with some idea that was totally without merit. And we have to go through it again and all. Not that we came to him, because we didn't.
With Martin Jr. Worked with the voters leading on?
No.
He didn't get involved in politics?
Never got.
Okay. Do you feel at all that he was influenced by growing up in Atlanta, that he did have a fairly decent relationship with the white community here?
Oh, Martin Luther Jr.? No, he had no relationship.
I mean, did Martin Jr. I mean, he did grow up, growing up in Atlanta.
He grew up in Atlanta, in Mohawk.
Okay. Growing up in
Atlanta. And why? And there was almost no social contact, if that's what you mean.
No, I meant that he grew up in a city where there was less violence.
Less violence. Oh, yeah, that influenced him tremendously.
That's what I was curious about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What sense would you think that might have influenced him?
Well, I mean, I know what happened with Kauai when we had controversial situation. He was always a peacemaker when they wanted to raise Cain about privileges and so forth. His whole attitude was one of, and then of course he had been really done very vociferously. He was a strong disciple. We discussed that many times. So that's where he got back.
I guess I was just wondering if he had grown up in Birmingham or down in
Atlanta. Oh, no. No, his early days. If you're a psychologist at all, you know your attitudes and convictions of formed long before he went there. I mean,
well, I know, but I mean, let's say had he grown up in a city where there was a lot of racial violence rather than the city of Atlanta, where there was less.
No, when he was projected into that situation, which was vicious in Montgomery, he just rebelled against everything. But he would never accede to indicate that he would use the same tactics.
So I guess Gandhi was the main influence.
Gandhi was the main influence
rather than what was happening here in this city.
It certainly was, rather than that or his father. I know personal experience. He and his father didn't get along, me and his brother.
But I guess I was just curious, growing up in a city where there weren't contacts between whites and blacks, at least on the political level, that maybe in a sense he grew up in a more non-violent racial.
He wasn't active in anything while he was here, either at the Y or as a boy growing up, because we didn't have that type of thing, or in the adult situation. Morehouse wasn't very active in community activities, never was. No, it was all student body, in other words.
What was the role of the universities in the civil rights movement in the 60s? Were they involved in it?
In the beginning, it was a standoffish thing. They were afraid. And they finally, Morehouse led in that too. And they finally had a meeting with the trustees and student barricades and maybe. But that was something that grew over a long period of time. It was a long time coming. It happened in North Carolina, sit-ins and other things before it happened here.
So the students really pulled the school
in. That's right.
How about your relationships with Ivan Allen? Is he pretty decent?
One of the best.
Yeah.
One of the best.
I spoke with him earlier.
He came to New York and offered me a job here, top job, which I refused after I left. He and I had a very long conversation about it. I told him I had just reached a point where I had given my whole life to Atlanta, and I was, when we broke the ball, very voters leaked up. I was really sabotaged, but I just couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm. You think he was operating out of honest feelings towards the black community? Or just
always. No. Ivan Allen, I can tell you, he went up to support the civil rights, forming the civil rights position in Washington and to vote for it when his job almost was on the line.
When he testified for
the court. That's right. Ivan Allen was one of the finest persons we ever had. The only mistake he made was putting the barricades up on Haven Road. You know about that. Now, that was crazy. Even I urged him not to do it, put himself on the line. I said we weren't ready for it at that time, but he voted for it. I mean,
for the 64 civil rights act.
Yes, sir. That, right in that room 4 in YMCA, we met there, and he'd come down anytime anything came up. We had the best relationship with anybody. We had this Ivan Allen. He was a gentleman. This is what I kept saying all the time, that if you get a person of some culture in refinement, Hartsfield was a segregationist of the first water, grew up very poor and all that. It's too bad if money is involved, but if you don't have the background, you can't express it.
It wasn't well educated.
That's right. That's what we're up against. What we used to call redneck. And redneck ran this town for a long time. And to get them out and to get the best class of people, the better class of people, you can work with them. You can work with them.
I guess both Hartsfield and Allen probably got a lot of opposition from the redneck community about what they were doing.
It was a Negro vote every time. It was solid. By that time, we had 25,000, 30,000. So, if you had that vote solid, you could get in. It wasn't enough to elect a black yet, but we still...
Not by the 60s? Not only...
No, it wasn't. We didn't have enough.
Not for mayor, but...
All this started after the... When they started moving out, you know, after the... anti-segregation.
You know, the white side.
Yeah,
it's, I guess by mid-60s with Grace Hamilton, Julian Bond, you know, actually, you know, there's more of them to pick up on things.
That was in the middle 60s. I left in 65. Maybe I shouldn't, but...
You went to best be yourself, I suppose.
Well, it was a... I never made the money, that's number one, and I got me double salary. I said money never influenced me, but by that time I found I needed an improvement in my financial situation. But that was another challenge. I went up there because one of the main reasons the people they had in steel and right neck was in debt up to their neck. Every YMCA has to operate independently, and they were in debt, which I had to pay off. And, I mean, it was real steel going on. I had to remove the wire. It was open house or not. That's a job I shouldn't have taken at my age because just, I solved it. Put them on the sun for initial basis after 4 years, but I paid for it with a heart attack. So they have to get up in the middle of the night. They were stealing money on the desk. It's a very big operation, $1 million a year.
Where's the money?
135th Street in 7th Avenue.
If I went to CCNY.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're in
college, sorry.
Oh, CCNY is right over the hill. Right?
Yeah, so I think I go to...
Oh, you're a graduate of CCNY?
Yeah.
You're one of the best schools in the country.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's rough and it's tough. I mean, are you Jewish?
Yeah.
You are Jewish. It's 80% Jewish.
It was. I don't know what it is now.
Well, I know CCNY. I was appointed by President Truman and spent 4 years in Washington as Racial Relations Director for the Housing Administration. That was back in the 50s. And I had been very active when I was first at Harlem. I was there from 30 to 35, right after I came out of school. And before the war. And I had and worked with the committee The first committee, they accused this man of as being a communist. What do you call it then? He was a professor. And I had meetings and so forth because I knew him. I can't remember his name, but it was the first big case. And I was a program director of Harlem at that time. Because when I went back as director, that was the second time. And I didn't know that the Daily World and others had been right. I never saw a copy of the Daily World. I might have seen a copy from time to time, but I don't remember. But when Truman appointed me, McCarthy and the others were very active. I was after I'd been there 6 months as director, I was brought up on charges. Not brought up, but I mean, I was asked to explain. They told me I had the right of counsel. I said, I don't need counsel. I've never been a member of the Communist Party. I don't even know who they are or anything about them. But I did support this group and let them meet. And then it was during the thing in Spain, that group. Those two groups were finally designated as communist-inspired groups. But I was program director, and I let groups meet there, and I didn't sit them too much, but I attended many of them and sat in on them sometimes. Anyway, they brought this thing up, and they asked me if I had counsel. I said, no, I'm not going to have counsel for you. And it went through about an hour and so forth, but they gave me an absolutely clean bill of health. And I was just doing my duty, allowing people to meet. And that's what everybody was doing.
There was somebody, I guess they called Communist Front organization.
Communist Front, yeah, one of them was.
It was a committee against war and fascism.
Yeah, that group met there.
Yeah,
but there was another professor at City College. It's a very famous case. He won out, by the way. You know, a lot of teachers were brought up affiliation. But this was a very famous case. I can't think of that man's name. A professor at City College. And I did know him, and I thought he was being persecuted like a lot of other people.
I guess City had a bad reputation for leftist politics.
It was our leftist politics, yes, but this was during the McCarthy regime, but I didn't spend a dime, and I just presented my case and evidence. I was simply acting as program director, and these people were meeting there, and I'd never been even approached to doing the communist party. But that was what they went when I came here. Many years later, first thing they did, appropriated $500,000 and two or three other foundations. I raised over $10 million in the grant. But the first thing they did was do a complete background check on me. When they found I wasn't a communist or wasn't affiliated, they had all this information too. And then I began to get money. And that's...
Did you ever come into contact with Woodruff?
Oh, I met him. Yeah. Yeah, I knew Mr. Woodruff very well.
Did you ever get any sense that he was as influential as people say in terms of...
He's a very private man.
In terms of civil rights.
Yeah, he never did it. He never took any stand on anything.
But I always heard that he was the man behind Hartsfield for pushing him in the
right. Bob Woodruff did anything that was in the interest of his business or Coca-Cola. But when you got to know him, as I did, talked with him maybe three or four times. And I had to be a substitute to get in to see him the first time. His secretary was a friend of mine. And the first time he said to me, how did I get an appointment? I said, well, I talked over this with the Lord, and so I said, I decided I could talk to you. But he laughed, and then I know. Anyway, he gave me $500,000 to build the West Side. He gave me $500,000 to build the camp. So I got $1 million and then several other foundations.
And it's a very difficult job because you had to work in an atmosphere that was very difficult. You had to be absolutely sure that they didn't think you were radical. And I don't know what a radical is, because I say what I think. Nobody has any idea, any misinterpretation of where I stand on anything. But it worked out pretty well. I had to do the same thing when I was back to New York as an executive. I had to clean the house first. I had to sit on a lot of people that were all black, but I didn't draw any punches at all.
So you were back there, let's say, in about 67, 68?
I went back in 65.
That's just when I left.
I went to 65 and stayed there until 69. And I had to turn the whole thing around. I had to fire the executive, the treasurer, members of the board, and everything. I had an awful list.
I can see why you were under a lot of stress there.
And I got a heart attack. But it had to be done. The chips had to fall where they were before. Now, nobody went to jail. They could have gone to jail because it was outright fever. But I worked it out so that we retired two or three of them, took their retirement for a certain number of years before they reimbursed them. So nobody came on to me. But I believe in compassion and understanding, but strict, honest, being part of anything that's perfect.
Well,
I don't know whether I've helped him.
Oh, yeah, it did, really.
Well,
no, it's good to get these memories out.